from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been hot sometimes and cold sometimes, but for 5+ years now, Americans have lived in the midst of an economic expansion. The rewards may not have been equally shared, but it beats recession any day. Now economists are looking out on the newly dawned 2007 and asking if the growth train can go on. American consumers have been a big engine for years now, but the fuel for that consumer spending was a boom in home prices that is officially over and could yet go really bust. Inflation is mild, interest rates are manageable, global growth is strong, the stock market ended 06 flying. Can it all go on another year? Up next on Point, we'll look at jobs, wages, housing, and the U.S. economy in 2007. Joining me first today from Washington is Greg Ipp, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His paper just came out with its big survey of economists looking ahead at 07. Greg Ipp, Happy New Year. What does your big economist panel say?
Happy New Year to you, Tom. And our panel is looking pretty optimistic. They are expecting basically a soft landing in 2007. And they've got a bit of history behind them, because if you look back at the last two economic expansions, the expansion of the 80s and the expansion of the 90s, we went through sort of a soft landing at the midpoint of both those cycles in 84, 85, back in the 80s, and in 95, back in the 90s.
Kind of lull before a roar.
Exactly. So we're sort of on schedule. And the classic soft landing scenario is that the Fed raises interest rates enough to slow the economy down, take a little bit of the steam out of the inflationary engine, but not so much that it overdoes it and puts the economy into recession. And that's what we're seeing right now in the forecast. People are expecting annual growth of 2.3% in the first half of this year and about 2.8% in the second half of this year.
So below what, 05 was 3.2%, 6
sure,
was 4.1 early on, but then slowed down substantially.
That's right. We're running at around 2 to 3% annual rate in the last half of last year. So that would be a slowdown, and that's a bit below what the economy normally grows at, and it wouldn't be enough to soak up all the new people looking for work. So we would probably see the unemployment rate in the scenario rise gradually to just shy of 5%. It's right now 4.5%. But in a recession, you would probably see that number jump up to around 6%. So again, it's a everything goes right soft landing scenario.
So take us behind the number then, Greg. What are the big elements here? I mean, one thing I see them saying, pointing out, that the American economy has gone so heavily to a service economy that in part, we don't have a manufacturing vulnerability anymore because we don't have manufacturing.
That's right. I mean, there are definitely sort of two tracks in the economy right now. One has the sort of big ticket items of manufacturing and housing, which is very weak right now. I think everybody knows that the bloom has come off the housing rose. And you have the service sector, which is stuff like healthcare and education and finance, and seems to be doing relatively well. Now, that said, I wouldn't want to go too far with this argument that we're not a manufacturing-driven economy any longer, and that doesn't matter, because the fact of the matter is there's a lot of linkages between manufacturing and the rest of the economy. People who, you know, build cars and make houses, they also go to restaurants and see the doctor. And so if they're finances are under pressure, that will be felt elsewhere. And I would also caution that these sectors, especially cars and housing, have traditionally always been the first to lead us into a recession and out of it. So the fact that they're both doing badly is not necessarily something we ought to be too happy about. It would lend some credence to the notion that the risk of a recession is higher now. But I would also point out, Tom, that just this morning, the Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index, which is a longstanding and fairly closely watched indicator of the industrial sector, it came out with a reading of 51.
How
That's
is that?
Above 50. And any number above 50 is an expanding manufacturing sector. It had actually fallen below 50 in November, and that had a lot of people saying, oh my goodness, recession around the corner. And the fact that they just told us this morning that it went back above 50 in December is a very positive sign.
So service businesses now, according to your paper, the Wall Street Journal, making up 80%, about 80% of the nation's economy, but that manufacturing sector still matters. Greg, what about housing? People have watched with sort of glee as it went up, if they owned a home, and some dismay as it's gone down. What's the risk factor around home prices now?
I don't think there's any doubt that housing is the biggest risk factor hanging over the economy right now, Tom, and it's in two areas. Number one is just the jobs and incomes that are involved in putting up new houses. The home builders industry has been one of the fastest growing in recent years, and they have definitely gone through significant retrenchment. The number of new houses they're building has fallen by about a quarter since the summertime. And we've only just started to see layoffs in that area, and those are going to gather steam in the coming year, almost certainly. We're talking hundreds of thousands of jobs lost. The second thing that's an issue is what happens to the price of homes. We know that people have been borrowing heavily against the value of their homes in recent years, mm-hmm. either by taking out new, larger mortgages or home equity loans, and using that money to buy other things, sometimes to renovate their house, sometimes to go on a trip. And the big question is, if their house price isn't going up as much, will they spend less? I would say that right now, Tom, the evidence is that it doesn't seem to have had much of an impact on people, partly because even though prices are weakening and they're down a little bit, they're up, I think, like 50% in the last 5 or 6 years. So it's not like there's many people out there feeling terribly house poor.
Still a residual gain there. What about interest rates in that picture? It's what, something like 17 hikes in a row. Ben Bernanke seemed a little uncertain, but now confidence seems to have grown in him. And there's talk of interest rates turning back down, the Fed turning its rates back down.
Yeah, a year ago, if you were to talk about what are the risk factors facing the economy in the year 2006, a lot of people would have said, well, you know, the maestro Alan Greenspan is retiring after many years, and an untried fellow, Ben Bernanke, is taking his place on February 1. And in the early months, he did have a few rough spots. He had a little bit of trouble trying to communicate his message that they might stop raising interest rates but are still worried about inflation. And there was a weakness in the markets, and inflation did seem to take off in the middle of the year, and these things both seemed to test him. But he had a forecast, which was that inflation would moderate once energy prices stopped going up, and that the economy would slow as the housing market came off the boil but would not mm-hmm. fall into a recession. And as we enter 2007, all the elements of that forecast seem to be coming true. So I think the world at large, and the markets in particular, are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, and the transition from Greenspan to Bernanke has gone relatively smoothly.
There was a fair amount of concern about inflation a few months ago, but it seems to have moderated. Where does it stand? What's the outlook?
Well, inflation has really done a round trip. It went up as high as well over 3% earlier this year. In fact, I think it hit 4% in the middle part of the year because gasoline prices, as you'll recall, were going over $3 mm-hmm. a gallon. And since then, we've had a sharp drop in gasoline prices, which has pulled the overall inflation rate down to about 2%. And our panel sees that number dropping further to about 1.7% by the middle of this year, and perhaps edging back up to around 2.5% by the end of the year. And that's more or less in the zone that the Fed would consider price stability. And assuming that that is in fact what we get, it doesn't put a lot of pressure on them to raise interest rates. On the other hand, if this soft landing scenario also comes true, as they expect, there's not a lot of pressure to lower interest rates as well. It could become very boring on the Federal Reserve front.
You have 50 or 60 economists you talk to, more than usual this time. While on balance they said it's going to be good, more than usual they were divided in their opinion. What does that suggest, Greg?
It's always the case that as you reach sort of turning points in the cycle, which we do seem to be at, people's opinions diverge more. As I mentioned, we are seeing some of the harbingers of recession, such as weak housing, such as weak automobile sales, and a rise in interest rates, all of which have been forerunners of recession. And so it's natural that this would be seen as a time of higher risk, and different forecasters will put different weights on those various risks. I like to compare it to an airplane landing. A soft landing for the economy is a bit like a landing of an airplane. We know that a lot of crashes take place on landings and takeoffs because that's when the airplane is closest to the ground. And similarly, recessions tend to happen when the economy is slowing down because it's just closer to that tipping point. But that doesn't mean it usually does go into recession, just as most airplanes do end up landing safely.
So there we are. Pick your metaphor. Greg Ipp at the Wall Street Journal, always great speaking with you. Thanks very much for being with us at the dawn of 07.
Thanks, Tom, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Joining me now in the studio is Alan Sinai. He's chief global economist at Decision Economics, a financial advisory firm based in New York. He's former chief global economist at Lehman Brothers Global Economics. He's got the big view and a sharp mind and brings it all home. Alan Sinai, thanks for being with us. A soft landing, is that the way you would describe what we're headed into in 2007?
It's one way to describe it. We talk about it as touch and go. We went down this year because we had a big recession in housing and residential mm-hmm. construction, softness in consumption and in autos. We're getting some inventory adjustments in response to that. We touched down at about a 2% growth rate. We're now lifting back off and headed for, we think, a little bit stronger than the consensus view that Greg talked about for growth of the economy. It looks like a good year.
So the soft landing idea here, as Greg described it, is a kind of touch and go that has come low and then take off again. We saw what happened in the late 90s. Do you see us on the verge of, you know, sort of we've skimmed these lower growth rates and now headed back up into boom times?
Nope. Nope, not that. We've downshifted to, on average, a lower growth path because we won't have the kind of boom in housing and the support from the financial side of housing for consumers that we had before. So we just should grow adequately, but not anywhere near the boom sort of way that we did grow. In fact, if we did do that, then the Fed would raise interest rates a lot and make sure it didn't happen.
So for the typical American family this year, what does this economy mean? Sort of steady as she goes, look where you are now, it'll be that plus a bit? Is that the outlook?
You know, not as good as it has been. A little tougher on business. Profits growth won't be the same. But the jobs market still looks like it's going to be pretty tight, and the ability to get more wages and to bargain for more wages for most workers is going to be the best it has been in years.
Alan Sine, a lot of people feel the economy, I mean, there's jobs and wages, and then housing has been so huge. Let's look at this housing piece for a minute. We hear all kinds of things. Maybe it's turning around. Maybe it's got a lot further to fall. How do you see it?
You know, it's on the home sales and starts side, it has kind of stabilized, but I don't think it's over yet. It's just that the rate of decline in what has been a severe housing and residential construction recession will be less. And that helps GDP because the decrement isn't quite as big, but it's still going to be a soft, tough housing market, nothing near what we saw. And what we're not sure yet, and what we're very concerned about as a risk to the economy, is how far down do housing prices go? And then in turn, given that we have all used the housing ATM machine to fund so much of what
not
we've
all,
done.
Not all, but an awful lot of people. Yeah.
You know, how does that play out? It's a very new phenomenon. We really had an incredible housing boom. It was bubble-like in a number of places in the country. And we've had a swift and decisive and huge housing recession, which is part of why the economy got so weak in the middle and second half of last year.
How far has it fallen, and how far could it fall? You've got baby boomers who may be downsizing from their homes. Is there enough of a market coming in behind to pick up the whole thing and carry prices, or could we see a permanent step down, and what would the consequences be?
You know, I think we have to have a permanent step down in prices for the demographics to pick up again. The demographics are very supportive for good growth in housing at the levels of starts and home sales we see now. The problem is prices are very high, and affordability has gotten difficult for lots of American families. That has to get rationalized. So what's most likely to happen on this side of it is we just won't see much activity above what we're seeing now, and we may have some further erosion. And I think housing prices on average are going to go down some more.
Can that be kind of set to the side after having been the centerpiece of a lot of economic activity for so long? Can that sit on the side sort of stagnant and have the economy overall still do well then?
The economy can do okay. It can be adequate. You know, the kind of growth numbers Greg Yip talked mm-hmm. about, 2.3 the first half, 2.8 the second half, and our own expectation, 2.5, 2.75 on average for this year. And your comment, which is that is a lot lower than what it has been. Mm. That's a perfectly adequate economy for the 6 year of expansion, but it's okay. It's not boom time. It actually is a good enough overall growth rate to keep the unemployment rate fairly low and the labor market tight, and that will generate enough income so consumers can do okay. But we won't get rich on real estate anymore, and some families are going to get poor and have to be foreclosed and go into bankruptcy because of the excesses of what happened in real estate. And in the worst situation, where home prices, because maybe we had a boom and we're having a bust, and you never quite know about that mm-hmm. until it happens. In the worst case, it could lever us into a recession like a recession economy. Chances of that, we say three chances in 10.
Okay.
But that's non-trivial.
That's not nothing.
That's right.
So housing sidelined here a little bit. Let's look at the two other pieces that people think a lot about then. Jobs and wages on the one hand, and the stock market on the other. It ended 06 flying. What have we got here? Something, the Dow's up 16%+ last year. The S&P 500, 13.6. NASDAQ, 9.5. I know this is a market watcher thing, not necessarily an economist, but is the economy positioned to keep supporting those kind of fairly high-flying stock increases?
You know, the stock market has open territory, U.S. and around the world, for a while here, until those valuations get stretched. And the reason is that fundamentally, the U.S. Central Bank is out of the picture. They're not going to raise rates. They may not lower them, but they're not going to raise rates. Long-term rates are stable. earnings have been spectacular. Mm-hmm. American companies, American-based companies really know how to make money.
Profits all over the place.
Profits are terrific, and they're going to still surprise on the upside. I think companies have learned how to use technology in a very cost-efficient way and keep on generating profits that grow far faster than GDP, and they're out of sight. They will slow down, but they'll still be very good. When we put that profits growth together with stable interest rates and a growing global economy and a growing U.S. economy, though less so than before, you have a recipe for a continuing bull market in stocks. So I think we're going to, easily see 10%. Now, 10% up over some part of this year. It may happen by the summer.
Sure.
It may happen first 4 or 5 months. It may take till the end of the year. That would put the Dow Jones at numbers like 14,000.
Record high.
Record high, and that would put the S&P 500 at 1550.
Mm-hmm.
And 10% is below the historical average rate of increase for the U.S. stock market over many, many years, so it's not a nutty number at all.
Right, right. But it's an amazing number. Even so, there's the rationale for the rosy scenario a lot of market watchers are articulating. What about the jobs and wages piece for people who aren't necessarily getting to play in that garden?
Oh, I think that we have the tightest labor market in the United States that we've had in years.
Does that bode well for wage increases?
Yes, it does. Yes, it absolutely does. It also is a problem for inflation on the cost side and for corporate earnings. But I think workers at a 4.5%, even 4.75% unemployment rate are going to find that they're going to be able to get paid more money, ask for and get paid more money, and they'll find more other jobs that will pay them more money.
What kind of wage increases are you imagining? What range of increases in
this year? Well, you know, I just learned today that a very big employer at the fast food Starbucks just upped the entry wage for new employees 10%, $8 to $8.80. And, you know, in this state, Massachusetts, the minimum wage went up, and it's going up in other states. Workers now do have more of the upper hand than they've had for a long time.
And maybe it's been a long time coming.
A long time in coming, absolutely.
We're going to hear from Ian Morris in just a moment at HSBC, but I want to begin to turn to our listeners as well. Steve's calling from Camden, South Carolina. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I keep hearing the president and everybody else telling us how good the economy is. And, you know, everybody I know and everybody I talk to, you know, I guess we're down here at the bottom of the economy. It stinks. You know, and I don't understand, who the economy is so good for right now, because there's a lot of us out here really hurting.
So you're not feeling it where you are. Let us look at that, Steve. And thank you for your call. Let me turn to New York to pick that up. Ian Morris joins us. He's chief U.S. economist at HSBC. He's currently responsible for formulating their view of U.S. economic outlook. Ian Morris, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We want to get your big view, but first respond to our caller there in South Carolina saying lots of rosy talk here, but he and his friends aren't feeling it. How do you interpret that?
Well, it's on the one hand, it's true the unemployment rate is, at a new cycle low at 4.5%. It's, that's a pretty good number. But at the same time, what we're seeing is income distribution is very much weighted towards the upper income earners. And it's not just, the top 20% of income earners that are doing well. It's also, it's more the case of the top 1% doing exceptionally well and the bottom 99% not doing as well, and certainly the bottom 80% not doing as well as the top 20. So you have that issue keeping real wages of the average person down by more than what you would normally see when unemployment is this low. So they're not feeling that that positive element yet.
Mr. Morris, let me ask you about that for just a moment. Set aside values or politics or morals, but just as an economist, does that matter? Can we have that skewed income distribution and still have a rosy economic scenario as an economist looks at it?
From a purely analytical point of view, you would see shifts within the economy, such as a shift towards luxury retailing sales doing very well, whereas average retailers or those that that take care of the towards the bottom end of the market not do so well. That type of shift goes on within the economy. There is also a sense that globalization is playing a role in making real wages of less skilled people lower than what would normally be the case as well. And that's obviously bad news for that particular worker, but it can be good news for the corporate sector who uses labor as a cost. If that goes down, they make more profits. They might invest in more new equipment in higher value-added production, which might create better-paying jobs down the line. But you can go through this transition process where it takes a while to see the benefits, and in the meanwhile, you're dealing with some of the costs.
You've noted that consumer spending is 70% of U.S. GDP, the big gorilla, your words. Can that go on? I mean, can all that be spent at Tiffany's?
Well, I don't think so, ultimately. And the last few years in particular, is as your previous guests have highlighted, we've been using the home as an automatic teller machine. And that process of home equity extraction, borrowing against your home to spend, is ending now. And there's a big debate about whether it will mean a hard landing or a soft landing for the economy. I suspect what it means for the consumer is something in between a soft and a hard landing. Not an outright recession, but something that's going to hurt a little more than what perhaps the consensus is expecting.
Alan Sina, how do you see income distribution and consumer spending in this picture?
I think the caller, in response to the call, he's probably in what Ian has described, lower 20%. We don't know that for sure, but that's my guess in South Carolina. The caller's in that 20%. And the inequality, the growth in inequality of wealth and income has been astounding the last few years. It is unsustainable as an economic matter and as a political matter. Now, I think we are getting a shift, and the wages as a percent of income are now starting to rise. It's been late, but it is coming. It happens in every business cycle that goes on long enough. And profits as a percent of the total will probably decline. But where it is really unsustainable is politically. And I would say that what we saw in the ballot box in November, in the election returns, where the statistics on the economy are, without a doubt, really quite good by standard ways of looking at
and
it.
And in spite of that, in the spite Republicans of that, got a kick in the pants.
Look at the election. And it wasn't just Iraq. It wasn't just international. It was the kind of thing that the caller was referring to. He and others like him are not getting a fair shake in the current situation. The upper income and higher income and educated people are. That, in our history, has never been sustained politically.
One way or another, the ballot box horns in to say, wait a minute.
And then you have a change, and then policies change, and then you get a redressing and rebalancing of the inequality in certain ways. And I think that's what's brewing in our country now for the longer run.
Let me go to Ann in Boston. Hi, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi, I just had a couple of questions about high cost. Mm-hmm. Higher education and health care are big political issues, and they're also out of sight. And
sure are.
In the public higher education sector, it's become so expensive in lots of places, particularly Massachusetts, but lots of places, that workers are either slowing down their education so long that it's ridiculous,
right,
or they're not going at all, and so they're not available to take what kinds of jobs they might have. And you put that together with all the debt, just the personal debt that people have. I worry about that, and I don't see it in the way that you're analyzing things. And you put that together with the income disparity, and I worry more than your callers, your speakers.
Ann, let us pick those up. Ian Morris, how about it? There's a different part of the picture. Ann's looking right at education costs and health care costs. Looking at what sometimes appears to be unsustainable, it's hard to make that jibe with the big macro rosiness that's being described. How do you see those pieces?
Yes, I think the costs of these types of products are obviously a bit of a problem. To some extent, they've been offset by falling prices for durable goods, autos or TVs,
cheap blue jeans, and expensive healthcare.
Exactly, but we don't buy those types of products every day. Mm-hmm. Whereas the cost of living every day is obviously still quite high. And in fact, some of the data that we have do show that people's financial obligations, their debt servicing as a proportion of their income, is pretty much at record highs. And that's been okay for now because the value of people's assets, such as their real estate, has been quite high. So even though their debt is high, their net wealth was also high. But now we may be at a turning point where real estate goes down. That will be offset to some extent by the stock market, but in net terms, it does create more vulnerability going forward. And it is a recession risk for 2007. It's just not our central case, but I totally acknowledge what she's saying.
Alan Sinai, you've said that we've got a lot of issues that we haven't been paying attention to. You said right at the outset that you see that President Bush's tax cuts as having helped buoy the economy. But I've heard you describe a lot of things not given adequate attention in these last few years, and those as a mounting risk factor. Describe that picture for us.
Well, you know, both the calls so far, particularly the one of the last lady, highlight the concern Americans have about the future. I think it's not so much that the here and now is really bad. It's that the future is of tremendous concern to them. It showed up in the election. It showed up in her question, because her question mentioned health care.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, 45 million uninsured Americans now on health care.
47, I read yesterday.
47. Mm-hmm. We have spiraling cost of health care. It is, for those of us who look at the budget deficit looking out of 2 or 3 years, the biggest drain on the budget deficit, which is going to be outsized anyway. And we haven't figured out how to rationalize the delivery and cost of health care. The inflation of health care is far above, as the lady commented, average inflation, and we have a rising number of aging people and beneficiaries. It's a big black hole of unsettled nature that the political process hasn't begun to address.
But now, there's this disconnect. Anne raises these issues,
yes.
Healthcare, education costs, and we also heard in our earlier call the economists going on about how things look pretty darn good, and then people saying, whoa.
Look, we talk about GDP. GDP right. is a number. 2.5, 2.8, 3.5. What does it mean to the average American? It doesn't mean anything to the average American. That's what your calls tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't mean anything to the average American. So we have to talk about that, because that's what we do. But when you get behind it and look at what really Americans think, they are troubled. And I think we have just a lot of big changes brewing. From a policy point of view, the only thing I think we really did tackle was the recovery of the economy and setting up the U.S. and world economy for good growth. And that's important.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush administration, I would give
Absolutely.
Them credit for that.
Rob is calling from Boston. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi. My question for your guest refers to the macro U.S. economy and where the money flows from the investment community may go. As someone who's looked at entering the real estate market over the last year and a half and decided to wait until just last week, I've seen personally how the housing market has declined. But if the stock market will only make up a portion of that recovery, where will the investment community put their money?
Rob, give us your logic circle. We don't need the details, I guess, but you got back into housing last week. Why? What are you smelling out there?
Well, we started looking a year and a half ago, just as the decline started in our market, and we decided to wait it out a little bit.
You feel like it's bottomed out, or you just have to get in?
I feel like it's close, and a little bit of we had to get in, but I feel like it was close. I didn't want to make that investment at the peak of the market and then have to sit on it for so many years.
Right. So if the money's not going to go into housing, where might it go? We'll look at that from a couple of angles. Let me bring in another voice to begin to address it. From Boston, we're joined by Christine Armstrong. She's Senior Vice President and Wealth Advisor at Smith Barney in Boston. Christine, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom, and thank you for having me on.
There's a direct question from a listener who says, okay, if housing is not where the action is, but there's an awful lot of money out there, where do you see all that flowing?
Well, housing and real estate should always be part of a person's portfolio, but people also need to be taking advantage of the equity markets, as your previous speakers have indicated. In particular, taking advantage of your 401k plan, at least up to your employer's match, also contributing to an IRA and broadly participating both in the domestic equity markets as well as the international markets.
So everybody knows these days you should be maxing out. It's not always easy to do, but once people have done the best they can, what mix are you recommending? Any changes in the kind of profile you're recommending to a typical American household, if you talk to such a thing, Christine, in where they put their investments this year?
Yes, because of the continual slide of the U.S. dollar, we're emphasizing even more the international markets, up to 40% of a person's portfolio, and that would include some exposure to the emerging markets.
And do you find most American investors that you deal with willing to do that, or do they feel nervous about putting money
abroad? Oh, they're very nervous about that. 10%, and they may think that they have adequate international exposure. 20%, a lot of them say that they may be done, but we're encouraging them to go even higher, up to 40%.
And Christine, what about how people are situated for retirement? You're a wealth advisor, so that says to me maybe you deal with people who've got some pretty fat bank, but are people well positioned? Are they realistic about what they need to be doing?
Unfortunately, Tom, not at all. People are only starting to wake up, the baby boom generation of which I'm a part, to the fact that retirement's just around the corner, and unfortunately they're saying, oh my gosh, I better get started now. And so many, many people, in fact, I think the majority are behind the eight ball right now.
Ian Morris in New York, what about this issue of where the money's going, if not into housing? We've heard a lot about stock buybacks and private equity, buying up firms, public firms, taking them private. Where do you see the big money flowing in this year ahead?
Well, it's always tough to sort of get a gauge of where the liquidity goes to. There are a myriad array of different investors, from hedge funds to private equity groups to mutual funds to private clients. And I would suggest that at least a portion of these groups are looking at the stock market, thinking that valuations there don't look too bad. So to get the possibility of a decent return, hoping for another good year in 2007 on the back of 06 might be the way to go. Particularly if the Fed's done raising rates, we might, in fact, my view is that the Fed will be easing, and lower interest rates tends to be good for the stock market. Bonds, I think people are probably a little bit hesitant about, even though there's some possibility that short-term interest rates will come down. There's probably not a huge amount of scope for long-term interest rates to come down. They're already very low. The 10-year Treasury government interest rate, for instance, mm-hmm. is only about 4.7, which is pretty low. And so people are quite nervous in that area. But, you know, we still, I think, have a lot of people thinking that the dollar will continue to fall. So that makes foreign investments in stock markets abroad look reasonably good as well. But don't forget, in terms of those flows, we are still very reliant on the foreign investor buying U.S. assets to keep things moving along. Because as a country, the U.S. likes to spend more than it earns, not on financial assets, but on goods and services. So we import a lot of that, and we need to borrow a lot of money. In return, foreigners buy our assets. So we still are very reliant on particularly foreign central banks, but foreign private investors as well.
Right. Hello, China. And if they ever stop, we're in trouble. Alan Sine, we always hear about that. It seems like a big iceberg out there, but it's hard to gauge if we're close to some problem there or far from a problem. I mean, how should, you know, ordinary people try and factor that into their personal financial planning?
We are not close to any major problem in China nor in Asia. It's the most dynamically growing part of the world.
In terms of them floating the U.S. debt?
Yes, in terms of buying debt, they'll buy less debt. And in terms of them floating their own debt and their own stock, it is the most dynamic area to invest in. It is, for an ordinary investor, it's got some risk. But I think the money is going to go for stocks initially this year, because it's open territory. There are no real recession problems at the moment anywhere around the world. And interest rates, while moving up outside the U.S., aren't moving up that much. Real estate in the U.S., I applaud the caller for having made a very good timing decision.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely. Although there may be some more price erosion, but he's probably saved himself a lot of money by not buying a year and a half ago. But the real estate money is probably going to be outside. It will go outside the U.S., both to other countries.
Commercial
to
property abroad.
Both residential. There are a lot of emerging countries that are very strong in growth where residential housing is very dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Real estate recessions are usually typical of a given country. The
right.
UK had one. Australia mm-hmm. had one.
Mm-hmm. Japan had one.
Mm-hmm. Japan had one. But it's not generic to the whole world. So the money, which is very fluid these days mm-hmm. and flows all over the world, mm-hmm. is going to go to real estate development outside the U.S., and prices will hold up there. But I think stocks are the place to go initially this year.
There goes the Copacabana. Let's get a call from Orlean, Virginia. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Mark?
Well, you know, I'd like to return, if I could, back to a comment which was made earlier about the lack of participation of a large segment of our population.
Mm-hmm.
There's an ugly truth which is being missed. One of your economists made a comment about the fact that equity prices have been increased because profits have been doing so well.
Yep.
Well, a large part of the reason why those profits are doing so well is because our manufacturers can raise prices pretty much at will within a certain competitive range. Everyone is paying for those increased prices, including the lower 20%.
Well, but inflation hasn't been so bad. Is that really what's pinching, or is it the failure to sort of share the goodies?
Well, that's part of it. The bottom line is that this rise in equity prices is also being financed by the very people who participate in it.
Yes.
And this is going to have long-term consequences in terms of our national productivity, because to compete in the global marketplace, you have to produce a surplus of goods of sufficient quality that people want to buy them. We have to invest in our people, and I think we're going to pay a long-term price for this, although on the short term, it's very good for the upper 20%.
Mark, let us pick that up. What do you say, Alan Sonny? You hear Mark's interpretation of what's going on.
You know, the lower, the less educated, lower-income families and individuals get squeezed two ways. They don't earn enough money, their wages aren't going up that fast, and they pay the higher prices for services and for manufactured goods, as a caller says.
Now, you say lower income and less educated, but earlier it was the top 1% we're talking about as the big gainers here. So are we talking about 99?
It could be more than 20. I'm using Ian's 80-20 set of numbers, and I would concede that it could be more than 20, that the families that earn together $100,000, $125,000 a year could be arguing the same thing, that they're squeezed on costs, they're squeezed on education costs and health care costs, and they're not participating on the wage side and getting that money back. That, as I said before, is unsustainable as a political fact of life. Sooner or later in the history of our society, that comes back in the ballot box, and we get a change, and we will get some redressing of the inequality and the squeeze that that portends.
We're going to talk about that tomorrow with Jacob Hacker at Yale and what the new Congress might do to address income inequality. Let me get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Kathy's on the line. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have heard two different things from people who don't seem to be talking to each other or hearing each other about baby boomers. One is saying that baby boomers, the rate of savings is going down and down in our country, and that's also true for baby boomers. And on the other hand, people keep saying, oh, there's going to be this huge flood of baby boomers that are going to retire and go on Social Security and all that. I don't think people can afford to retire. For one thing, health costs are so high, you need to stay employed so you can have health insurance. Hello?
Yes, we're right here.
Okay. And, you know, I keep getting these things from my retirement account saying, oh, you can put in another $10,000 a year. I don't have another $10,000.
Right. I mean, we're laughing, but I know it's not funny. Christine Armstrong, speak to Kathy. She's raising the issue. You know, what's going to happen here? People can't max out in that IRA, that 401k. Is retirement really out there for people, just whatever the economy is doing?
I think Kathy has an excellent point. Unfortunately, the bulk of our population are in Kathy's shoes. The demands of daily living, raising a family, addressing their education costs have prevented many people from saving for retirement. Also, the stock market bust, 2000 to 02, scared people, and when people saw drops in their 401k plans, they stopped contributing. And so what Kathy's saying, I think, is very accurate in that many Americans will not and cannot afford to retire. They cannot afford just to live on Social Security. So they're going to be looking at part-time, next-lifetime kinds of jobs, whether those are reduced-hour positions, whether those are opportunities they've never seen before. But I see that many, many Americans will not be in a position to fully retire, as we've seen in past generations.
You know, some of the people bagging my groceries lately don't look exactly like spring chickens. I'm not sure they want to be bagging groceries at that age, but there it is. Let me get a call from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Kirsten's on the line. Hi, Kirsten. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about a kind of a global issue, which involves both the conflict in Iraq and global warming, which is causing pressure on energy prices, meaning, you know, there are going to be pressure on politicians to encourage people to, you know, do hybrids or alternative forms of energy, maybe taxing fuel, and in addition to, you know, the Middle East conflict. And I'm just wondering what those energy prices could do to the economy.
It's a great question. Ian Morris, there's a lot of buzz around energy alternatives and industry related to that, especially with Democrats having a majority in Congress. What about energy and the green economy? How do you see that emerging as issues this year?
It's going to continue to be an intense topic of debate. You have China and India and the rest of the emerging world continuing to be very hungry with their energy requirements. So this is a global issue, not just a U.S. issue, and then you get into the costs and benefits of putting in environmental taxes, etc., particularly on fuel and energy as we go forward. That may have to be part of the solution ultimately, but it's a tricky one. Typically, you'll have some people feeling that the taxes will limit growth, and they would potentially prefer to improve the technology of environmentally friendly industrial production processes. And that's an important part of it too, but ultimately it has to probably be both. You need some taxes, but not too high, because you don't want to damage income growth in the economy. At the same time, we need to put more into making things more productive and environmentally friendly as well from the technology side. And I think that, you know, a happy combination of the two approaches will have to come out.
Alan Tynai, you talked about domestic politics and in the ballot box sense. What about geopolitics here? Kirsten raises the issue of energy, oil supplies, Iraq. Do you see geopolitics bursting in on this year's economy at some point, somehow? Is it vulnerable on that front?
We're very vulnerable now when we grow more slowly, as all of us have indicated. We're going to grow more slowly, and we have more risk around our economy than we've had before in terms of downside risk, sixth year of expansion. So it's going to be a more fragile environment to things like, if for any reason oil prices go up $10, $20, $30 a barrel, the demand out of Asia is going to continue for oil and energy a lot, because they're growing very strongly. And so we are underpinned on crude oil and energy costs, as we have been for a long time. And it does cry out for an alternative energy policy that is well thought out in Washington. And that, too, has not happened. On the global warming, that's a longer run issue. It certainly looks like it's happening. And again, both in the private sector and in the public sector, I think public policy requires we take a very good look at that and what the long-term ramifications are, and then whether any policy reactions are required, whether it's taxing and spending or not, is something we have to look at. Political system's not doing that. And on retirement, I must say the political system isn't dealing with that, too. Christine's absolutely right. Our research says we are woefully unprepared for financing retirement of an aging population. I think a lot of us want to keep working. I'm not a spring chicken anymore, Tom. I'm still enjoying working.
Good
and
for you.
I think a lot of people who choose to work part-time and bag the bags. But there are a lot of people working because that's the only way they get health care benefits.
Yep.
And that's kind of tragic to see that. Again, we are not in this country really dealing with the financial requirements of retirement, with Social Security, nor the healthcare problem. Mm. It's an unbelievable list of business that we've got to get to politically very soon, where time runs out and we get really behind the eight ball.
There's the big picture. Christine, 20 seconds here. What's the mantra that you would whisper in the ear of our listeners for the coming year?
As much as possible, get rid of your credit card debt. Please get rid of your credit card debt. That's number one.
Okay.
Have some kind of emergency fund for a 3 to 6 month time period. Take full advantage of all company-provided retirement plans up to the match.
And
go into a Roth or an IRA if you're able to, and then dollar-cost average with any ancillary money.
And save, baby, save, and good luck to everybody in the economy this year. Christine Armstrong at Smith Barney in Boston, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Ian Morris at HSBC in New York. Mr. Morris, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Alan Tynai, Chief Global Economist at Decision Economics. Always great speaking with you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Good luck this year. This is On Point.